With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I am joined by Heidi White and our very special guest, Karen Swallow Pryor. Karen, Heidi, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, David. It's good to be here.
So there's a lot going on, it turns out. And Heidi, you're like in the wilderness, right?
Right now I am sitting in my car outside of a brewery. Which I drove down. We're camping right now, and our listeners know we're big campers. And when I say camping, I use the term with air quotes because we have like air conditioning in our camper, and we bring like our sous vide and our dog, and I have a puffy mattress. And so, I mean, it's really just we have a smaller house that we take with us to beautiful places.
You camp like Colonel Brandon, I imagine, would have camped.
I'm great with that. Like, I don't care who judges me for that. I am comfortable. I sleep well. I have the best time. So anyway, we drove into town so I could get Wi-Fi so I could record the podcast. And I'm sitting outside a brewery on their Wi-Fi in my car because I love this book and I want to have this conversation.
So if all of a sudden she disappears, she probably got chased away by somebody at the brewery saying, why are you stealing our Wi-Fi?
Right?
Seriously. Or a bear.
Yeah, or a bear. Yes.
And Karen, you have a book coming out. Do you want to talk about the book, or should we save that for later? Or should people just check you out online?
Sure, I'll just briefly mention I have a book that I co-edited with a colleague coming out on July 9th, called "Cultural Engagement: A Crash Course in Contemporary Issues." Lots of essays by different professing Christians with different perspectives on a whole bunch of different controversial topics. So that's fine. Yay. Yeah.
All right. Well, so where's the best place for people to check that out? I mean, it's always Amazon, but is that what you would
say? I mean, you know, Amazon has some issues right now. I think they're fine, but Hearts and Minds bookstore is a great place. 8 Day Books is another great independent bookseller. So anywhere where you like to get your books is fine.
All right, great. Okay, so we are here to discuss Sense and Sensibility, Jane Austen's novel, one last time. Well, I guess one last time before we dive into listener questions. So next week, we will answer as many questions as we can. So we will have that thread up on Facebook, and you can leave your questions there. You can also email them to us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com, and you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at closereadspods if you'd like to send a question that way as well. And we'll get to as many as we can. We'll do some where we go really deep and some where we do go a little more rapid fire. And we'll get to as many as we can. And hopefully that will be a good way of closing out this discussion on Sense and Sensibility. I do have one question though that I need your help figuring out about this book, about the conclusion of this book. So it's a really... I don't want to say that it's a deep question because that is kind of the opposite of what it is, but so I probably should not say that. So here's what I want to know. Does Edward actually deserve Eleanor?
Oh, that is a deep question.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important question. Yeah. they're a good match. She's a good guy. He can take care of her.
Yeah,
it's
but
not
is
the big
he?
Romantic ending. Can no, it's he? Not Jane Eyre, reader, I married him.
Right? So. Yeah, that's true. It is a little anticlimactic in some ways how this sort of just all unfolds at the end. Karen, could you give me a little more than just yes?
Well, yes, I think so. We'll try.
Okay.
One of the dominant themes in this novel is the whole question of second attachments, right? And and so that language is odd to us because we live in a world where for, you know, most of us, even within, you know, Christian communities, I think. Yeah, there are attachments of various kinds, whatever, by the time we reach marrying age. Yeah. And Joshua Harris, notwithstanding. But this is like, in today's terms, Austin is confronting the idea of your one soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually important in advancing that theme that we have this great match at the end, or good match, wherever you land on that, that involves someone who had a previous attachment. And that's okay, because there is no one soulmate. And I think that's a big part of what Austin is communicating in this novel. You know, subtly, it's not like she's not preaching a sermon. It's not in your face, but this is an important theme.
Hmm.
Was that a big, you know, it's really, I'm asking this question to both of you, but specifically to you, Karen, was that a big deal in their culture? Like, there's so many, I've never even thought of that when reading this novel before.
That is another good question that I don't have a definitive answer for, but my sense is that this was a kind of a burgeoning underlying idea that would gain prominence with the growing influence of capital R romanticism, the, you know, romantic movement. And that Austin, this is part of her genius, is she saw this as a development that was coming, and she, you know, she basically foresaw it and was addressing it.
Sort of prophetic in a way.
Yes, exactly.
I find that so fascinating. I have a good friend that her mother, good friend who's my age, three kids, married. And this woman, her mother prayed her entire mothering life that her children would marry their first love. That was like a really big deal to her. And all of them did. All of them. And that is just, I had never thought of that as being something to value before. And when I heard that from my friend, I thought, oh, that's so fascinating. I've never thought of that before. Maybe I should pray for that, right? Like, I've never, that's not something I grew up valuing or really thought of to pray for, although it does make a lot of sense. And so you pointed that out, Karen, at the beginning of the discussions about this book, and I had never paid attention to that before in this book. And you're exactly right. It's a major theme. It's everywhere. But I had not even, it just went right over my head. So I just think that's, you know, I'm a close reader. I actually, that's how I make a living in this world. And I have not even seen that before. So thank you for pointing that out.
Well, I can't see everything, I guess.
I guess not.
I'm a crusader against romanticism. So this is my bread and butter. I see it everywhere.
I feel like we need to talk more about that. You being a crusader against romanticism. I feel like we should spend the next half hour on that.
Please continue. What does that mean?
Oh, wow. Well, I guess maybe the briefest answer is that my specialty, as I've said before, is 18th century British literature. A prominent figure there is Jonathan Swift. I mean, obviously he predates the Romantic period, but romanticism didn't happen overnight. And there was, you know, there was romanticism, small r, in literature from, you know, the classical age. And so Swift, the satirist, spent a lot of his works are actually very anti-romantic. And they're amazing and wonderful and smart and brilliant and true. And I love Jonathan Swift, and I'm like basically his disciple. So
did you, are you his disciple because you started out anti-romantic, or did you become anti-romantic because you're his disciple?
The latter. I learned from him. I didn't know what I was, and then I started studying Swift in 18th century in grad school, and I'm like, oh, because I was pretty much a romantic without knowing it, you know, as a young person, which most people are. We're all Marianne's until we learn better.
That's
and
true.
Yeah. It was Swift who taught me. Well, my professor, but you know.
So then you would make the case that Austin then is actively being Swiftian in that sense, that she is actively trying to subvert romanticism.
Yeah, I mean, she was really more of she was influenced by the Augustan and neoclassical writers of the 18th century more so than the, you know, newly emerging romantic writers. So I think she's very much a child of 18th century thinkers and writers.
So did, what was the relationship of the people who we think of as kind of leading the charge in romanticism to Austen's work? Do you have any idea about that? You know, the Wordsworths and so forth.
That's a good question. I mean, Austen, she was, you know, she was well received, but not, but wasn't wildly popular. That didn't happen until after her death. And of course, you know, she was taken from us too soon, but also, people like Wordsworth, for all their talk of, you know, the language of the common people, they didn't really, you know, they were still like, still traditional literary writers, poets. I mean, people weren't reading novels by women a great deal until Austen, you know, until she made her mark. But that is a good question. I don't really know. That's a good, we're coming up with a lot of great research questions in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe there, hey, it's another book for you.
Yeah. Thanks, David.
Okay.
So since you have nothing else going on.
I've thought of this while you guys are talking. So this is a brand new thought. I'm going to be formulating it in this exact moment. But with what you're saying about the anti-romanticism, which seems very obvious in the Marianne Willoughby Brent Crandon storyline, I'm wondering if that in some ways ties back to David's original question when you asked us, David, does Edward deserve Eleanor?
And I'm wondering, yeah, I wasn't going to let that go. We still need to talk about this.
Well, because here's my thought then, and maybe this will just seem obvious to everybody, but it's new to me, so I'm really processing this, that maybe one of the reasons why we're even asking that question is that that anti-romantic strain in Eleanor and Edward's relationship is Austen has to, in some ways, then write Eleanor not a big romantic hero. He's got to be kind of milk and water in some ways, because she is making a case that the woman isn't going to be rewarded with Willoughby, right? He's going to be a real person.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, one of the things that I was having trouble with, but that's putting it too strongly. I was thinking about how throughout the book, we know exactly why Marianne likes the men that she ends up liking. Even in the end, we kind of get, even though it sort of in a way glosses over her attachment to Colonel Brandon, we never really get any real scenes of them together. But then it kind of explains why she ends up falling in love with him. And we definitely know what she likes about Willoughby and what she thinks makes for a good man. But we get much less of that in terms of Eleanor. And so you have to read between the lines with her in terms of getting a sense of what it is she really sees in Edward. I think we know what she likes, what she values in a man as far as the virtues she values. And so I guess we can make the assumption that Edward at least is modeling some of those. But at times I was kind of questioning whether she would see those things in him, whether she would be that attached to him, except that maybe love is a mysterious thing. Right. But then how is that anti-romantic?
Well, he is worth as shown in the second half of the book by him keeping his word to Lucy. And that, and you know, that almost feels like this
puts him over the top.
In her eyes. Yeah. Well, that it secures her attachment in terms of her respect and esteem. Remember when Elizabeth said, or "Who is it that says I respect and esteem him? I greatly like him." Like that, that she has this respect and esteem for him, and she thinks highly of him. And well of him, and she's also in love with him. And so in that ways, he is redeemed in terms of his virtue from, you know, how foolish he had been before. Many people have pointed out on the Facebook page and even on this conversation on the air, we've talked about he really was wrong and to pursue her when he was attached to another woman. But I think that there is a strong redemption of Edward's character that we've seen over in the weeks behind us. But, you know, he's not the big romantic hero. He's not Willoughby. So, you know, we kind of left with that. Many, many people are left with this dissatisfied sense at the end of this novel, which I think what Karen's pointing out is that's kind of the point. It is not a romantic novel.
I think what I'm getting at is I just wish that maybe we could have used more Edward actually being in the book.
That's a fair point.
But when the book opens, I mean, basically, Eleanor has already, I don't even want to say the phrase fallen in love, because that's just not even part of all, you know, she already loves and esteems and respects Edward. Yeah, that's already happened.
Yeah.
So this isn't, so then we get,
fair.
So the contrast is, you know, we get Marianne's journey of falling in love. And so if we compare those two, where the book opens, this connection between Eleanor and Edward has already taken place, and their story is about overcoming the obstacles that arise. It's not about Eleanor falling in love with
right,
Edward.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. That's true.
It's a given, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that it's about Marianne's journey of falling in love, not Eleanor's. I mean, the idea of something being about something, I guess, is interesting, because we've talked about a lot of the themes, but I was, in reading it again, I'd forgotten how quickly, I guess, it all sort of wraps up at the end, because it's a pretty long novel that ends, I don't want to say abruptly, but it ends rapidly, you know, even more so than, say, Pride and Prejudice, which has the, I guess, a little epilogue at the end, right? Where it kind of explains what everybody else is doing at that time. So I got to thinking, what is this book? Like, aside from the themes, what is this book about? Because is it really about their relationship? Is it really about any of the relationships? We've talked about the themes that are covered in it. Is it about Marianne growing up? Is it less about Marianne falling in love and realizing her folly and then finding the right man or something like that? Is it really not a book about love at all? I guess is what I'm asking. Is that possible? When I say at all, obviously I'm being a bit hyperbolic. It's certainly about falling in love somewhat.
Right.
But is it about more than that? Is it about something different than that? That falling in love or being in love, you know, is superseded by?
I think it's about sense and sensibility. I mean, fair. I really, you know, these were.
So you're saying I'm asking a dumb question?
No. But it is helpful to remember that when Austin first started working on this some umpteen years before it ended up being published, started out as a work called Eleanor and Marianne. And somewhere along the way in her revisions, it became Sense and Sensibility, which means that there's a shift. It is more about these ideas and these concepts than it is just about the characters and their stories. And both Sense and Sensibility were really, you know, hot topics of the time that a lot of people were talking about. It's really, you know, the epistemology. How do we know what we know? Do we know more through sense or more through sensibility? I mean, this was a big topic, and this is Austin's contribution, I think, to that conversation.
So in some ways, she's incarnating a cultural dialogue as much as he is trying to, you know, give us, right. You know, it actually calls to mind Hemingway, what we were talking about with Hemingway on another show, where in some ways he seems to be incarnating a sort of confusion. And sometimes his characters can feel lean because of that. You have to read so much between the lines. And I'm not suggesting that Hemingway is as good as Austin or that they're very much alike, but they seem to be operating literarily on a sort of similar plane. I was just going to say, we're not here to talk about Hemingway, and we don't have to do a direct comparison, but it seems like there's something similar going on there in terms of how they're incarnating a sort of cultural dialogue that's happening even without people meaning for it to happen. You know, sometimes cultural dialogues, or maybe almost always, they happen sort of, you know, without us knowing that they're happening for a long time. And then all of a sudden you look up and you've been having a conversation for 30 years.
Right.
And I think that is one of the hallmarks of a great writer, you know, a great novelist or short story writer, is that they see their times and they're conversing with their times. They aren't, you know, again, preaching about them or writing, you know, didactic works about them. That's why, you know, people who do that aren't great writers, but great writers are very much prophets of their time. And so I think that's something, I mean, I think of Flannery O'Connor as well. She wrote about a very specific kind of world and time because she knew it so well, and that's where she lived. But it's still, you know, they're still universal stories with universal appeal.
Mm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Heidi, I think you were going to say something too.
Right. I think, and I'm going to hesitate to take a stand on this, but I'm going to throw this out there more as a question, specifically Coward. For Karen to reply to, because this, and the reason is because I'm bowing to the expert here. That's why you go to a new restaurant, you ask the waiter what to order. What should I order here? Right. So, because you don't know yet. So yes. Which wine goes with this dish? You asked the sommelier. So to me, I am not an expert in the 18th century novel, but I am a lover of literature and I do pay attention when I read. And it seems to me that out of all of Austen's novels, this is one, along with Mansfield Park, that feels to me the most didactic, the more like she's trying to make a point. Also, on this, on parallel lines to this, Austen is one of the great satirists and character developers in the history of the novel. So you know her characters, they're fully rounded, they have their own personality, they have this, they're really human. It's hard for me to believe that Eleanor and Marianne are not actual people that I know. Right? They're just lovely, like fully developed characters that are just like people I know, including myself. So I think that is one of Austen's great gifts, is she draws these amazing characters. But at the same time, this novel does feel like she is making taking a stand on something. She's making a point in her culture when she's saying this is right, and over here there are people that get it wrong. Whereas some of her other novels just feel more like character studies when she's not necessarily trying to draw some kind of moral comparison. She's just telling a good story.
So you said you were going to ask a question, but you didn't.
So is that true? along with what you were saying, David, about Hemingway and about these bigger issues and the prophet for the age, that was something that Karen said. Am I right? Mm-hmm. Am I on the right track there?
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the marks of immaturity of this novel, is that it is a bit more didactic, more obvious, and less artful than her later works. Mansfield Park, it has those same problems maybe in different ways. But I think most readers probably, I mean, people either love Mansfield Park or hate it. they point it out as her best or her worst, and I think it's for the reasons that you say. So yeah, I think what you've described is accurate.
Well, so what you brought up there actually called to mind another question that I wanted to ask each of you, because we spent quite a bit of time talking about the ways that maybe this novel is maybe a little bit more immature, or she started it when she was barely 20 and it doesn't quite live up to, say, Pride and Prejudice or Persuasion or something like that. So my question though is, Let's set aside that part of the conversation, because I'd love to focus on what do you think are some of the unique traits about this book that do stand out in comparison to some of her other work? Are there some things she's doing in this book maybe better than other works? Maybe there's not, you can say that, but what are some of the positive traits that are particularly characteristic of this work that maybe you enjoy more than in others of her books? Are there any instances of things like that? Or is it just? Or is it really just? She hasn't quite hit her stride, but she's just a genius. So it still gets close. Karen, what do you think? Do you have anything in mind for that?
I think that's a good question. I think that what we talked about before, I really like the fact that this isn't Eleanor's falling in love story. I like that the story opens and this connection has already been made, and it's not about that. And it's just about the social obstacles and the personal obstacles.
There's not that Elizabeth and Darcy battle that the novel kind of centers around.
Right. I mean, I think that's something that many people would see as a weakness, but understanding what she's doing, it becomes a strength. And it makes it a different story and about something else. And I like that.
Mm. That's interesting, because in some ways I can see how maybe that makes it feel perhaps like it has doesn't have that sort of unifying conflict or some, you know, some sort of unifying maybe conflict is what I'm thinking of, that just kind of drives the plot. And so sometimes it feels like it's a little bit unfocused. But I guess to your point, it's actually an example of the way it is focused. It's just not focused on the things that maybe we as readers most obviously want, or maybe it's just we've been conditioned to want something over the 200 years since then.
Right. And I mean, so the conflicts are mainly external for Eleanor, as opposed to internal. We're all about the internal. I mean, she has some obviously, but we're all about the internal conflicts. And we get a lot more of that in Pride and Prejudice. Mm. That's much more modern.
Yeah. And I'm struck by how a lot of the conflicts are conflicts that other people are enduring, and they're meaningful to her because of how much she cares about people, like her sister. Marianne has to endure a great deal, and Eleanor's relationship to that is supporting her sister. You know, it's meaningful to her because of how much she loves her sister and how much she worries about her. And in some ways, I could see that is that a criticism you've heard from people? This just occurred to me. I could see people saying, "Well, it doesn't. She's not enough of her own person in this novel."
Mm-hmm. People say that, yes.
Do you buy that?
No, I think that's ridiculous. But I think we've had that. We've talked a lot about that.
Yeah, we have.
Conversations that we've had. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Heidi, do you have anything in particular that you think stands out about this novel? Like I said, we've talked about things that maybe ways that it's not quite as mature. But in what ways do you think it is uniquely Jane Austen, or it is uniquely great, I guess?
Yeah. So I find this novel to be very soothing. I'd like to read this novel because the message that I always get from Sense and Sensibility, even more than some of her other novels, is it's okay to live an ordinary life. Like, you're not selling out. This is what life is. Find a good man who loves you and live a lower middle class life like this and be happy. Right. And I think that I find that to be very soothing and refreshing in kind of this chaotic age of like, go find yourself, like live extraordinary. Right. Like, just that is delightful. And the strong attachment that the sisters have. And I think some of the conversations on the Facebook page, and of course that's typical of Austen, but so many of the conversations I've seen take place on the Facebook page, I think are just exactly getting at the heart of the novel, which is, let's explore these interpersonal relationships and find ourselves in them somewhere, you know, without having this pressure to live an extraordinary life. And, you know, it's not Jane Eyre again of like, go find this troubled man that you can fix who has a crazy wife in the attic and that'll be your grand love story. So that's just not normal. And I like how Austen depicts a normal life, depicts an ordinary humanity. Mm-hmm. I find that to be delightful. And I think she does that extraordinarily well in this particular novel.
Mm. Do you think, either of you, do you think that that is as evident in her other work, like Persuasion or Emma or Mansfield Park or Pride and Prejudice, I guess? Or would you say that's actually unique to this book?
I'll answer this quickly. I think that that is kind of across the board for Austen, that there's kind of this depiction of ordinary human life. Mm-hmm. But this is the novel, I think, that it is kind of the moral punchline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I find at the end of Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth does become pretty rich. So
she does. And so does Jane. And they jump up a social status. And they, you know, like,
there's... It's a big success story.
Yes.
It's almost American.
This is a little bit different. Yeah, this is a little different. Especially since Eleanor is the one who is kind of the heroine of the novel. And she doesn't end up with as much money as Marianne.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Is Persuasion, I haven't read that in a while, does that cover some of these same subjects, Karen?
Which subjects? You mean like, what Heidi was
what Heidi's describing
about?
There, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's hard for us to translate because everyone in Austen's world, well, except for maybe Fanny and Mansfield Park. But they all seem more upper class than most of us, or their world is, you know, is wealthier than ours. So it doesn't seem ordinary to us. But what Heidi was saying is exactly right. You know, I mean, ordinary is sort of relative, I guess. And so in the worlds that Austen depicts in all of her novels, the women are ultimately living ordinary lives and finding love and happiness in that ordinariness. So, but I agree, it is more obvious in this novel.
So I hesitate to bring this subject up again, because it is something we have kind of, talked about ad nauseum on this podcast over the years. But would you say, well, okay, it's also going to come down to how you define your terms, but would you then say that Jane Austen's books, and this one in particular, are sort of anti-ambition? Like, are they?
I'm laughing, Karen, because this is a very, very common conversation.
Go ahead. I did not. Yeah, I don't know anything about the context for this.
Well, we've just had a lot of conversations over the years about various characters in books who are ambitious and the degree to which that's good and bad. And it turns out people just define, or their first instinct. People have very different responses to the idea of ambition. For some people, it's a great, it's a positive thing. And then for some people, it's a very, very negative thing. Just their first response is, and it seems to have a lot to do with how they heard the word used over the years. You're talking about the idea of a kind of normal, everyday life, and this idea that, you know, it seems like the characters in this book who try to reach the highest kind of, it never really works for them. Now that's not necessarily true of Pride and Prejudice, because as we said, both of them move up a level in the society, in the culture. So does it feel like Austen is like that she views ambition as a vice or a virtue? Like if she had, what's the opposite? And what would be the book title if you had the word ambition in the title? The Sense and Sensibility, ambition, and I don't know what it is. But do you think she views it as a vice or a virtue? Karen, I'll go with you first.
Well, again, it always depends on the definition of terms. And so, I mean, ambition, depending on the word. So ambition in virtue ethics, I mean, it's, if we use that as sort of a virtue, you can have an excess of it or a deficiency.
Right.
And so I think, I mean, so if ambition is like doing great deeds or something like that.
If your ambition is to do a lot of great things.
Yeah. Okay. So doing that in excess is a vice, and lacking it is also a vice of deficiency. So I would say that Austen wants her characters in this novel and in the others to do good things, at least. And for the women, of course, that means choosing a marriage partner well, making a good choice and living well. So for example, again, to go back to Pride and Prejudice, this is a good question. My mind is really spinning, but so Charlotte Lucas maybe aimed too low. I mean, she was satisfied with her choice, but from Elizabeth's perspective, her standards were too low, for a marriage partner. So I think that Austen does play with this question in maybe a different way.
I was thinking about the concept of contentment. Is Austen trying to make the case that her characters, like, was Marianne's problem that she wasn't content and that she was thus reaching beyond what she should have been reaching for? Or, you know, and I don't mean just like socially, I just mean she was allowing herself to slip into vice because she wasn't content with what was either available or most obvious, or, you know, within range, or I don't know, however you want to put it. Again, I haven't thought about this. I'm talking as I'm thinking. I'll put a question mark there and let you now take over the thinking out loud.
Thanks, David. I It's a good question. And I think that's more of a modern question than an Edwardian English question. Marianne's problem...
Is that a criticism? I can't tell if I'm being criticized right now.
No, well... I guess what I'm saying is, again, if you're defining the terms of a question, we have to put the question within the context in which it is originally propounded to the audience, meaning that what I think Austin is pointing out Marianne's problem, that's for certain. Like throughout the entire novel, she is using Marianne as a virtuous young woman who is almost led astray by herself and others, but is kind of brought back into the fold.
Let me stop you there. Is this, yeah, for clarity's sake, not because I think you're going to say something dumb now. Is she being led astray by an outside force or by her own vice?
Right. So I think the answer to that is both. Marianne is foolish. She's young and she's foolish because she has bought into this cult of sensibility, which is in many ways a reflection of her own flawed and disordered desires within her own self. So it's both. And it is her disappointment in love. It is Willoughby's villainy and betrayal that we've talked about so much that then gives her the opportunity to repent. And she does take that opportunity. And that is how Marianne is redeemed. I don't think that Austin is saying that that's because of the reasons that you just asked me. I think that she is more trying to point to, again, this problem with the cult of sensibility within the culture at that time, that's the problem. And Marianne kind of represents it, and not as an allegory, but as an example. But the ambition question is important because there are so many, and I'm going to say this, I think this is true. Again, I think Austin writes women better than men. And I think in these novels, there are so many women who are ambitious towards the wrong things. Lucy Steele, right? Mrs. Bennet. Like, there's disordered ambition towards marriage and social status and money. That is a huge theme in Austin, but not the heroines of her novels. They fight against that. They live in virtue, and then they are rewarded.
Karen, would you like a turn to think out loud now?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's more social criticism, like with Mrs. Bennet and Lucy Steele. Yes, they have character flaws, but I think Austin's also showing how it's the culture that is disordered, that's created this desperation on the part of young women and their mothers, because their options are so limited and their position is so tenuous in this kind of society. So, you know, it's like, you know, denying women an education and then accusing them of being shallow. I mean, which, you know, we still have that sort of thing going on the internets today.
No.
You know, so I think social criticism is, I think Austin is concerned with social criticism as much and sometimes more than character development, at least in terms of the minor characters.
Yeah. This is interesting stuff, I think.
But speaking of character, there were a couple passages I wanted to make sure that we got to, since this is the end.
I had reserved a section at the end of the podcast to make sure we covered passages that you guys liked, that you wanted to do that. So let's turn to it now. We've been going long enough.
Well, it's not so much, I mean, they're just important. They aren't necessarily, well, all right, there is one I like, but I think there's a lot I like. Two key things that happen in this last part of the novel have to do with the character of Marianne and the character of Eleanor. And so in chapter 10 of volume 3, which is, I don't know what chapter that is without the volumes, but it's where we get Marianne's you know, turning point, her repentance, her development clearly spelled out. When she says, I saw in my own behavior since the beginning of our acquaintance with him last autumn, nothing but a series of imprudence towards myself and want of kindness to others. I saw that my own feelings had prepared my sufferings and that my want of fortitude under them had almost led me to the grave. My illness, I well knew, had been entirely brought on by myself to such negligence of my own health as I had felt even at the time to be wrong. Had I died, it would have been self-destruction. This is her confession and repentance of her extreme sensibility that not only has harmed those around her, but she recognizes has actually harmed herself to the point where she almost lost her life. That's really dramatic and big and profound. And then we did talk about this an episode or two ago about Eleanor at the end and how the film version maybe exaggerates a little bit or a lot of, you know, what happens to Eleanor. But it does say, and this is chapter 13, so that's like the next to last chapter, I think. You know, when Edward comes in, that famous scene in the book and the film, and the narrator tells us, but Eleanor, how are her feelings to be described? Well, because she's been talking about Marianne. From the moment of learning that Lucy was married to another, that Edward was free, to the moment of his justifying the hopes which had so instantly followed, she was everything by turns but tranquil. But when the second moment had passed, when she found every doubt, every solicitude removed, compared her situation with what so lately it had been, saw him honorably released from his former engagement, saw him instantly profiting by the release to address herself and declare an affection as tender, as constant as she had ever supposed it to be. So everything's revealed. She's free. They're going to get together. She was oppressed. She was overcome by her own felicity and happily disposed, as is the human mind, to be easily familiarized with any change for the better. It required several hours to give sedateness to her spirits or any degree of tranquility to her heart. She really is, you know, has lost her tranquility, her senses through this. And so I think the film actually does do, it doesn't exaggerate it a lot more. It just makes it more visual than verbal. Mm. So so Eleanor has kind of lost her senses for a little bit, overcome with this joy and happiness. And so that's her change.
And Mary, so they always said that they have the inverse
yes.
changes yeah. between them. I love the moment where Eleanor has to leave the room.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think she finds out that, you know, Robert married Lucy. And so then she practically ran out of the room and he just kind of watches her go. I think I love that little moment because it's so unlike, Austin has spent so much time, so many times, being so careful to tell us how still Eleanor keeps herself. Like she doesn't even get up when people come into the room half the time. She doesn't, she gets up at times to be polite, but when she hears things that make her sad or upset or bad or whatever, even when she's sitting with Marianne, she just sits there over and over again. When Marianne's sick, she just sits there all night long. And then here in this moment, she gets up and moves. And that little bit of action is, I think, a really nice bit of characterization and drama. There was something else I was going to say, and I forgot what it was, so go on.
Well, I'll just say one of my favorite lines in the whole novel is in this part as well. When Eleanor, she's moving, sitting down, I will be calm. I will be mistress of myself. I love that.
Yep.
Heidi, do you have any other passages that you wanted to make sure we touched or that you just enjoyed?
So what's really funny is that it was both of those passages. Which goes to show how important, it goes to show how important they are and how satisfying they are to us as readers who've been waiting this whole time. And I think part of what we're waiting for is for Eleanor and Edward to get together. But mainly what waiting for is for Eleanor to be happy, to not have to be mistress of herself so much, right? But to be in some sense freed from this kind of constant vigilant restraint that she has had to have over her emotions, the sense she's had to display throughout this whole novel. And there comes a time when it just feels so good to us as the reader to see that relaxed and to see her just happy. And I think that's lovely.
The thing that's amazing about it, though, going back to that scene that I just mentioned, is just that she doesn't just kind of like, it doesn't just like burst forth and with like a waterfall or whatever, you know, to use a silly metaphor there. There's still propriety going on, right? She still kind of is ruling herself enough to, you know, step outside.
Yes, and even in her happiness in the passage, that's why I love the passage that Karen, that you read. I love that passage a lot because that shows that it really is just Eleanor's natural. This isn't about society. This is about her. Her natural inclination is she wants to be mistress of herself, right? She desires to be alone, to regain kind of that composure that is part of her, not just because it's expected of her, but because that's her. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I think is a little wink from Jane Austen is on the very next page after that, but Eleanor, how are her feelings to be described passage?
This is in 13.
Yes. About Robert marrying Lucy. And I think that's the weakest point in any Austen novel ever. Like, I just really think that's weak. I think that's a weak point. And I think that Austen knows it. And so here she, I think she's winking maybe at herself a little bit, certainly as to us as readers. I think this passage is brilliant. It's Eleanor wondering how Robert could have married Lucy, saying Robert could be drawn on to marry a girl of whose beauty she had herself heard him speak without any admiration. A girl, too, already engaged to his brother, and on whose account that brother had been thrown off by his family. It was beyond her comprehension to make out. To her own heart, it was a delightful affair. To her imagination, it was even a ridiculous one. But to her reason, her judgment, it was completely a puzzle. And I think that's how every reader reads this little thing that happens. You're like, wait, what? Like, and Austen just writes it into the novel. I think that's kind of brilliant.
Karen, were you going to say something in response to what she was saying?
No, I think I might have cut out a tiny bit or something here. But
okay. I love that. I do love the bit in chapter 13, though, where it's Lucy's letter to Edward, where she's like, I have long lost your affections and I decided your brother was better. But then her PS at the end of that is like so funny, where she says, she ends the letter, your sincere well-wisher, friend and sister. And then she says, I have burnt all your letters and will return your picture the first opportunity. Please to destroy my scrawls, but the ring with my hair, you are very welcome to keep. Yes, I can't get it back anyway. That line is the most Lucy line of all the Lucy lines, I think.
That's pretty great. That's great.
Okay. Well, all right, we're almost out of time here. So go ahead and touch on some final thoughts. Again, next week we'll have plenty to talk about because people will ask their questions. So we'll be able to fill in the gaps that our listeners are feeling the tension they're feeling because we didn't cover something. But Heidi, I'll let you go first and then Karen, I'll turn to you. Final thoughts on at least this portion of the conversation of the novel.
Sure. So I'm expecting then, since we didn't really talk about it today, some conversation, some questions in the Q&A episode about Colonel Brandon and Marianne, which is in many ways one of the most controversial authorial decisions that Jane Austen ever made in her career, is to marry off Marianne to Colonel Brandon. So I'm expecting some lively conversation about that on the Q&A thread whenever we post that. But I'm a big Colonel Brandon fan, so I'll just throw that out there.
Karen, where do you stand in the Colonel Brandon Marianne?
Oh, I think they're a great match, and Marianne just didn't know it until, you know, she just didn't know what she needed and ultimately therefore what she should want and did want. I think one last point that I want to make is just the way the novel closes in terms of its last couple of sentences, because it's a weird kind of closing. It's telling. Between Barton and Delaford, their two homes, there was that constant communication which strong family affection would naturally dictate. And among the merits and the happiness of Eleanor and Marianne, let it not be ranked as the least considerable that those sisters, and living almost within sight of each other, they could live without disagreement between themselves or producing coolness between their husbands. That's how the novel ends.
Right?
About how two sisters got along and their husbands got along. And it is not about their love and their romance, but about their family rapport and relationship. I think that's important.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because I was thinking about that because it didn't even occur to me that they wouldn't get along. Like, just given what we know of them. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised. I was thinking, well, why did she tell us that? And then when you think about it, it's like, well, clearly she's making a grander point here. It's not like she had made some mistake along the way. Do you want to talk about that more?
Well, I think, you know, it's the idea. I mean, when you marry, we still say this today, but we say it because we don't remember it. Austin knew, when you marry a family. And so two sisters who are single, who love one another, get along, is an entirely different thing than two sisters who marry into separate families, live near one another. I mean, again, even the opening line has to do with the family being settled. Families are often not settled in Austin's world. And so, I mean, in the best and in most important senses of the word. And so the fact that these families settled near one another and remained happily so is important, apparently, in this world.
That's the almost like the bigger resolution than any of them. Yes. Actually just getting married.
Yeah. Right.
Especially given that the book, I guess, is to begins with the dissolution of, or maybe the first steps towards dissolution with their father dying, and then the possibility of them all being swept off to different places and their mother being alone, and who knows what happens to Margaret, you know,
and their
possibility.
Their brother rejecting, their half-brother did reject them.
And the sis and his wife rejecting them.
Right.
The in-laws not getting along.
So I hadn't really thought about this. So that's a complete, the ending is a complete, the picture of the family at the of a family at the end is a complete reversal of the picture of a family we have at the beginning.
I wonder if that's true in Pride and Prejudice too. I mean, in some ways, I guess it is, because they're not it's a kind of a uncomfortable family dynamic in the beginning of Pride and Prejudice, but then they all, I don't know. I have to think about that. Heidi, final thoughts?
Well, just this whole section on Willoughby too, here at the end. I find that so fascinating that he, clearly remains in love with Marianne, and yet there's this couple of sentences here that are just so fascinating to me. He lived to exert and frequently to enjoy himself. His wife was not always out of humor, nor his home always uncomfortable. And in his breed of horses and dogs, and in sporting of every kind, he found no inconsiderable degree of domestic felicity. So Austin doesn't even give us, you know, some like drunken, homeless, depressed and sad Willoughby who, you know, cannot live without Marianne and is destitute all of his days and unhappy with his wife. Like he's okay.
He's content. He's content. You can be content with the wrong things.
We don't get the wife burning in the attic, right? We get none of this is going to be the big romantic story. So, and I think that's just brilliant on Austin's part. She's like, these are ordinary lives. It felt very intense for a season of time, and then everybody moved on.
Never occurred to me that Willoughby could grow up to be a Rochester. That's a new one. That's a new thought. It's Rochester, right? In Jane Eyre?
Yeah. Yep.
I guess lucky for whoever comes to live with them and watch their children. That's probably a good thing, I suppose. all right. Well, thank you. Although that would be, someone has to have done a mashup of those books, right? It's got to be a mashup somewhere.
I'm sure there is, yes.
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies version. Well, thanks to you both for chatting. Next week we will, as I said, answer questions. So we'll post a thread, get that up today. And then if you want to email them, you can email us at closereadspodcast@gmail.com. And then on social media, it's at closereadspods, because for whatever reason, I couldn't do the other ones. Couldn't include the A-S-T-S at the end of that. So, Close Reads Pods on social media, closereadspodcasts@gmail.com to send in your questions, and we'll get to as many as we can. Don't forget about all of the Patreon stuff. We have the episode on Ernest Hemingway that we did, and coming up soon, we're going to have a poetry episode for the month of July, and then also another short story for the month of July. Karen, you are going to be with Heidi and I at the conference next week.
Yes, so I'm so excited.
I think you'll probably meet a couple listeners there at least. I know a handful of people will be there, so I'm sure you'll get to sign autographs or sign babies or something.
I can sign my sermon notes.
I saw that.
I don't do sermons for anyone, any trolls listening. That was a joke.
Yeah. Just Google it. Just go on Twitter and Google it and you'll understand what she's talking about. That was some good trolling by you though. Just there.
I learned from the best.
All the ones who troll you on the internet.
Yes.
All right. So your book is coming out on the 9th and people can find that on Amazon or 8th Day Books or wherever they like to buy books. And it's called what again?
It's called Cultural Engagement, A Crash Course in Contemporary Issues.
All right. So be on the lookout for that. Congratulations on getting that done.
Thank you. It was quite a labor of love.
I hope that the, I don't know, press tour or whatever you're doing for that is not too, too overwhelming over the next week or so.
Thank
good,
you.
Good luck with that. For Heidi, for Karen, and for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Happy reading, and we'll talk to you next week.